I want to start with 100 years ago tomorrow, May 4th, 1917. Two events happened. One was the first Americans in uniform arrived in the theater of combat. They were U.S. Navy sailors aboard six destroyers, medium-small warships, and they arrived in Queenstown, a city now called Cove in southern Ireland, and they arrived there, and this was less than a month, just under a month after the war had, U.S. had declared war. They arrived there to take part in anti-submarine warfare in the eastern Atlantic to protect the ships. Within a month or so, they would be escorting convoys. So the first people in first Americans in uniform in peril were in Europe 100 years from after tomorrow. The other thing that happened on the 4th of May in Washington, D.C. was the U.S. House of Representatives voted for the Espionage Act. And I'll talk about that more. It passed in the House of Representatives. One of Montana's representatives, John Evans, voted for it. The other representative, and you all know her name, Jeanette Rankin, voted against it. And again, this was just 1 month after she had voted against U.S. entry into the war at the beginning of April. So that for you. That's the thing about the First World War. Not every day, but at least once a week, there's something that happened 100 years ago. And now with the U.S. a month into the war 100 years ago, more and more of it's about the United States as well. I want to start off with several quotations that will encapsulate and preview this. Now imagine a gun owner, and there may be among you here, a gun owner hearing this announced over broadcasting. Within 30 days from the passage and approval of this act, every person within the state of Montana who owns or has in his possession any firearms or weapons shall make a full, true, and complete verified report upon the form hereinafter provided to the sheriff of the county in which such person lives, of all firearms and weapons, including edged weapons, which are owned and possessed by him or her. Montana did have gun registration, and it was in 1918 by a special session of the legislature, the same session of the legislature that passed the Sedition Act in February of 1918. What I don't know, and I've never read about, is how effectively, how thoroughly this Gun Registration Act was enforced or promoted. It may have even varied county to county, but there was gun registration in Montana as part of the war. This next quote is from someone who was against American entry into the war until 1917 and then became very strongly supportive of entry into the war and critical of people who continued to oppose American participation in the war. What I am opposed to is not the feeling of the pacifists, but their stupidity. My heart is with them, but my mind has a contempt for them. I want peace, but I know how to get it, and they do not. Woodrow Wilson, speaking to the American Federation of Labor in November 1917, 7 months into the war. The last quotation in this preview is the thoughts of a character in a novel by a very popular writer at the time of the war. This novel was written during the war. It was published in January of 1919, just 2 months after the war ended. It's the thoughts of a German-American farm boy in eastern Washington. His great ordeal had been the need, the terrible and incomprehensible need to kill something intangible in himself. If there was German blood in him poisoning the very wells of his heart, he could have spilled it and so, whether living or dead, have repudiated the taint. He longed to live, to beat with iron mace and cut with sharp bayonet and rend with hard hand, to kill and kill and kill the hideous thing that was German. Zane Grey, a book called The Desert of Wheat, one of his lesser-known works, justifiably so, but set again the wheat fields of eastern Washington, full of the wartime hatred of Germany and antipathy towards the industrial workers of the world. So what I want to cover today is some of fill out the story of that these things fill out the larger picture of which these quotes are a part. And to start with acknowledging that whatever the United States did, what the United States went through, what the government did, as we went into the war, in those first weeks and first months, the precedent had already been set almost 3 years before. Europe went to war in August 1914, and within a week or 2 weeks or 3 weeks, governments on the Allied side in republics and constitutional monarchies were in, the parliamentary bodies were enacting laws that increased the power of the government, stripped or denied, restrained citizens from their rights, and started to put restraints on people's lives, on the press, on alcohol, on freedoms that they enjoyed. And even by 1916, daylight saving time. Daylight saving time became a government mandate during the First World War. So if you don't like government daylight saving time, and not only did it begin during the First World War, the first state or political entity to actually enact it was the Germans. So in Britain, in the first week of the war, the first week of August, the British Parliament passed an act called Defense of the Realm Act, or its acronym is DORA, Defense of the Realm Act. And it started putting restraints and setting the pattern for further restraints on everything from what hours the pubs were open to people who had carrier pigeons, a favorite hobby in Britain. If you lived near a military establishment, you either could not have carrier pigeons or you had to get special, make special arrangements with the police. But it also brought with it restraints on expression and the press. So this is from a modification of the Defense of the Realm Act in the 12th of August, 1914, second week of the war. No person shall by word of mouth or in writing spread reports likely to cause disaffection or alarm among any of His Majesty's forces or among the civilian population. So the rapidity with which governments that went into war started using government power to impose, regulate, the lives of civilians, what had begun in 1914, and of course by the time the U.S. enters the war, much of this of course is known at least to people in the U.S. government of these precedents. As one historian wrote about this, that the power of the state trumped the rights of the individual. And when the press or the public was discontented with this, often it was, as the same person wrote, because it wasn't harsh enough. The press and public grew angry more because not enough was done than because the state had become the enemy of civil liberties. So the United States obviously is not part of the war through 1914, 1915. The sinking of the Lusitania got some people wanting to go into bring the U.S. into the war, including former President Roosevelt, Theodore Roosevelt. But the U.S. stayed out of the war through 1916. Woodrow Wilson ran for president and was reelected in November on his primary platform, is he kept us out of war. And that was what many people voted for him for that reason. And he had defended American, justified American neutrality. And but in early 1917, that would change. German government announced it would resume unrestricted submarine warfare. The British intelligence revealed the Zimmermann telegram in which the German ambassador in Mexico was directed to go talk to the office of President Carranza of Mexico and encourage them to join Germany and wage war on the United States. And if this worked out, they could get Texas, New Mexico, and Arizona back. And so scholars have said even these two things, submarine warfare, the Zimmermann telegram, many Americans still were not ready to go to war. Very few people in America traveled by steamship across the Atlantic Ocean. They could live with boats being torpedoed with people. and the Zimmerman telegram. Very few people, I think, even at the time, took it seriously. The Carranza couldn't even control his own country. There was civil war in Mexico. And there was a wide range of people who opposed, as it looked like the U.S. was going towards war in early 1917, up to the actual declaration of war. There were a fair number of groups, influential groups, who opposed the war, going into the war, on general pacifist concerns or on concerns specific to the war. This is a war for rich people fought by the poor people. You had socialists and more radical people, the industrial workers of the world. The suffragists were often pacifists, as with Jeanette Rankin. You had people from Germany and Austria living here in Montana, the fourth largest group of foreign-born citizens or foreign-born residents in Montana in the 1920 census were Germans. There were Austrians as well. The Irish, especially Irish nationalists. There had been a revolt in Ireland at Easter Monday in 1916, crushed harshly by the British. The last thing a lot of Irish Americans wanted was the United States going into war on the side of the country that was crushing Ireland. There were Finns who resented Russian colonial domination, imperial domination, and didn't want the United States going to war on the side of Russia, which at this time it was the revolution, the first provisional government after the revolution. So there were Scandinavians, many in northeastern Montana, who came from countries with a strong tradition of neutrality in international affairs and wanted to see that. There were farmers who thought this is going to take away labor necessary for the harvesting and crops doing spring work. So there was a large number of people who opposed the war, entering the war before and even opposed it afterwards. But the United States went to war. Wilson called a special session of Congress. It passed the Senate with a vote of 82-6. On the 4th of April, the next day, it passed the House of Representatives. Jeanette Rankin was one of 50 representatives voting against entry into the war. In Wisconsin, 11 representatives in Wisconsin, all but two of them opposed entry into the First World War. It was a place of a place with strong socialist presence. A lot of German Americans lived there as well. So the vote was not anywhere near unanimous, but it did obviously. The United States, the Congress did pass it. And Wilson signed on the 6th of April, signed the Declaration of War. And now he faced a problem. For 2.5 years, closer to 3 years, he had been telling Americans that this was not our war, that this was not our concern, it was not our business. And now he had to do a very Trump-like thing. He had to completely reverse himself in a very short time. And he had to convince Americans that not only was this part of our business, but they should get riled up about it. This is what another scholar, David Kennedy, wrote about, the position the United States found itself in. And one thing to note is when we went to war in April, we only went to war against Germany. The three other central powers, Austria-Hungary, Bulgaria, and the Ottoman Empire, we did not go to war with. And we would go to war with Austria-Hungary at the end of 1917, but for the middle part of 1917, we're going to war only against one country. And the government had to convince Americans not that this was just a necessary war, but that Germans were despicable, that they were barbarians. And the peculiar thing about this, or the factor, was there was not a lot of Germans were not an immigrant group in the United States that had been the recipient of prejudice and harsh feelings. This might have been, it wasn't like, say, the Slavs from Eastern Europe, the Southern Mediterranean Europeans, or the Irish. There were prejudices by many Americans against them. The Germans were Northern Europeans. They were seen as much like British people and in the inner side. But now they were bad. And not just the Germans over there, but what happened is the German Americans in the United States became part of this. This is what David Kennedy wrote about the task the government took on in selling the war and the reason for it and the More than any other belligerent governments, the Wilson administration was compelled to cultivate, even to manufacture, public opinion favorable to the war effort. Lacking imminent peril of physical harm, Wilson had to look to the deliberate mobilization of emotions and ideas. And because Wilson was a progressive who believed in the power of education, in the power of explanation, this is one more line from Kennedy. For progressive reformers, particularly, faith in publicity as the chief instrument of reform was axiomatic. 1 week after the declaration of war, one of the first new, and there'd be many new government institute or government bureaus and agencies created for this war. Big government didn't be, in the United States didn't begin in the 1930s. It began in 1917. But one of the very earliest of them was the Committee on Public Information, which started off with the noble idea of informing the American people about the war, the reasons for it, the way it'd be fought, but fairly rapidly became a propaganda bureau, starting to publish atrocity stories that the British had been peddling for 3 years by this time. Some of them were true. The Germans, especially in Belgium in 1914 and 15, behaved atrociously and created, but not all the atrocity stories were true. And that didn't bother Wellington House, the British propaganda agency, and it didn't bother the CPI, the Committee of Public Education. So it became education, but also it relied more and more on emotions and responses to emotional responses. So that's some of the background about the United States coming into the war. The title of the talk is Loyalty and Dissent. So for loyalty, what I want to look at is one of, and I assume almost all of you have read this, heard this, that of all the states in the Union during the First World War, more Montanans, proportional to population, served in the military forces, Army, Navy, Marines, than from any other state in the Union. And an auxiliary to that is that more Montanans died in service of the First World War than from any other state. This is how it's put in one of the standard works of Montana history and policy, High, Wide, and Handsome by Joseph Kinsey Howard, published in the 1940s. This is how he says it about Montanans in the war. More of them marched away in proportion to population than from any other state, and more than from any other state proportionally would never march anywhere again. Before there was a draft law, 12,500 Montanans volunteered. This was 1,000% above the national average for enlistments. This, when the selective service system was set up, draft quotas were based on population estimates, and the estimate for Montana, God only knows why, was 950,000. Whatever the reason, the estimate was an incredible blunder. Montana's actual population was 496,000. There are several alternative facts in this summary here. And that's what I want to address, because Montana, I think, is, as an entity, attached to this belief, not just for the First World War, but maybe for military service in general. And so I want to look at this, because I'm still exploring this. My hypothesis is that officials, maybe it was the adjutant general of the state in the early 20s, selected statistics that would match, that would make this possible, to make this claim possible. And it has to go we know how many people roughly served in the military. There are actually differences in figures, but it basically is probably in the 36,000 to 40,000 in the Army, Navy, and Marines. So that's close to fixed. So to have the highest proportion of any state in the Union, you actually need to have a relatively low population so that this fixed number down here will become a larger part of the whole. So the population estimate at 490,000 in the Kinsey Howard piece, that would make the service people about 8% of the state population. And the way it's worked is based on census. The census, of course, are taken every decade. And so you take the, here's the, this is the body language PowerPoint. Here is the 1910 census. Here is the 1920 census. What the calculation assumes is a steady, consistent level of growth, climbing at a steady rate from 1910 to 1920. At 1917, you cross that line. That's your number. That's the 491,000. What actually happened, different evidence suggests, is actually the population grew very rapidly from 1917 to 1910 to 1917. The homestead boom, Butte was booming, reached a peak around 1917, and then fell precipitously from 1917 to 1920. The population in Montana in 1917 was much more than in 1920. Now, I don't know how much, tens of thousands probably, perhaps 100,000, perhaps close to 100,000, 200,000. The state in its official publicity publications encouraging homesteaders, economic development, issued by the Department of Labor, Agriculture, and Industry, estimated that Montana had a population in 1916-17 of 750,000. That would be 200,000 above what the number recorded in the 1920 census. I don't think Montana lost 200,000 people, but I think it may have lost a fair portion of that. So the point of this is that the 40,000 people down here that are the service people, the lower that number is, the higher the proportion of the population are. The higher you raise that population estimate, the smaller they can become of a proportion, smaller proportion they become, maybe just like some other states. And it's, I don't have an answer to this. I don't know. I'm agnostic on it so far. But one suspicion is the adjutant general either wanted to or was told to make the numbers look good. So he lowballed the population figures to give that. So what can one say about Montana's participation? Western states tended to be above the national average. On a national average, 4% of the American population ended up in uniform during the First World War. 4 million out of about 100 million. And so 4% rate. I suspect that Montana was one of three states, and this is based on census, and again, so maybe a bit low, was one of three states that had the highest rate, about 6%. Montana, Wyoming, and Nevada. Western states, still with a bit of frontier, Montana in 1917 probably had 30% more men than women, so that means that there a larger portion of the population is subject to the draft. But here's the counter evidence. When on June 5th, 1917, all men in the United States between the ages of 21 and 30, a decade's worth of men, were to go to their local polling place, wherever they would vote, where they went to vote if they did vote, and they were to register with the Selective Service System, which had been created just a month earlier by Congress. And the number, and so 9.5 million people in the United States did that in that age group. Almost 90,000 in Montana, 88,000. The number of Montanans who went on June 5th to register with the Selective Service Commission was above the number of people who went in states with twice its population, Florida and Colorado. Those states had near 1 million people in 1920, and yet Montana had more people going to register. So there's things about population, number of registrants, census, it's all mixed up. And I'm not sure it can ever be resolved, but it's a background to that story. I think the claim that more Montanans served is something that was created early by the state adjutant general, very consciously, and that's something that I've only relied on published sources. I've not done any primary research, but that is some of the background, and it's confusing. I'm still unsure of it yet, but that the number of people that Montanans, I suspect the claim that more Montanans died proportional to population than any other state may be close to true. 934 Montanans died from Montana, and that may have been up to 2% of the state population. On the national level, it was half of 1%. So that may be true. And that may have more to do with the units they were assigned to and the tasks those units were assigned to. Montanans ended up in divisions, the 41st and the 91st, that took on some of the extra tough fighting in the Meuse-Argonne and in around Ypres in Belgium. So that may be true, but again, some of these probably can never be confirmed. So that's the loyalty side. And it obviously is not meant to question the loyalty of those who did serve, but the numerical assumptions may remain fuzzy for a long time. Now I want to move to a loyalty on the other side, dissent. Because that, in some ways, is perhaps probably of more relevance today. I want to start off by defining sedition, a term that obviously will come up. And this is from a dictionary from 1914, some excerpts from a dictionary of 1914. Incitement of discontent against government, inflammatory speeches or writings tending to breach a public order, stirring up of commotion in a state, threatening a state or its authority. What it means in the United States in the context of 1917 and 1918 is crippling or undermining the war effort inside the United States and doing anything that might aid or comfort or benefit the enemy. That's the language you'll see there. Acting against your, or what is, or at least what the authorities perceive as acting against the best interest of your own nation or doing anything that might encourage the enemy. And again, this the United States passed a law. The U.S. government passed a law in May. The House voted on May 4th, and it would become part of dealing with sedition. The law was actually became called the Espionage Act. The first section of the Espionage Act it was signed on the 15th of June, 1915, by President Wilson, became law at that point. It is still the law of the land. And spies who are caught or who have fled overseas are subject. Edward Snowden, for instance, subject to the Espionage Act, is alive and well. But the first part of the Espionage Act is fairly conventional. It prohibits people from spreading any information or photos of military installations, military vehicles, news of military operations to anyone who that would use it for the purpose of the enemy. So that's a fairly conventional part. But the other part is more of a sedition. Section 3 is a sedition act, and it is against, the language is people who make false reports or false statements that will undermine the war effort. And saying that a false statement could be that Wilson is a warmonger. That would make you subject to the sedition portion of the Espionage Act. The main way the act was intended to be enforced was through the U.S. mail. And the purpose was to monitor and stop the mail of groups and organizations whose newspapers, whose publications went through the U.S. mail, the socialists, pacifist groups, and others. And so it was primarily directed at groups that used the mail. And the Postmaster General of the United States, in a sense, became one of the chief censors or bureaucrats for monitoring or trying to crush sedition. He was a Southerner, Burleson, and heavy-handed, and Wilson pretty much stood back, as president, stood back and let Burleson administer this as he chose. So this became the law of the land on June 15th, 1917. And again, statements about questioning U.S. purpose, about the justification for war, those could be called false reports or false statements. One of the great frustrations in Montana was that it was a federal law. It was enforced, prosecuted, and enforced by the federal judicial system. Montana is a federal judicial district. At that time, there was just one federal courthouse in Butte on North Main. There was one federal judge, George Berkman, and one federal attorney, who would Burton K. Wheeler. It was up to them to decide. Cases would be brought to them, made known to them. It was up to Wheeler to decide whether this merited prosecuting, taking that person to court. Wheeler believed in the First Amendment, that you could say whatever you wanted, that the First Amendment was not diminished during wartime, and that short of being a true danger to the United States, that whether it's labor organizers or socialists or suffragists, that they could do what they wanted. And sometimes when there was a prosecution and it went to Berquin's court, the federal judge, he would let people off, but he said, well, that's, you know, they said they liked the Kaiser, and but they're no threat. They have no influence. They're this lonely person. They're not going to, you know, there's almost no chance that they're going to actually cause any trouble. People in Montana, more pro-war people, were very frustrated with both Wheeler as federal attorney and Berquin as the federal district court. And so they decided, well, first I want to read a quote from Burton K. Wheeler. This is from his memoir published in 1962. And it's partially interesting because this issue, as he wrote this, still bothered him. So he's talking about, he's the DA based in Butte, federal district attorney. Immediately after the United States declared war on Germany in April 1917, I was confronted with mass hysteria over alleged spies and saboteurs, and it still saddens and angers me when I think about it. Up to then, Butte had been divided sharply between the interventionists and those who hated the English. The Irish miners, always the most vocal in the community, naturally had no sympathy for the British, the oppressors of their homeland. Many other nationalities, such as the Finns, had strong socialist leanings and opposed the war on ideological grounds. They maintained it would further enrich the capitalists at the expense of the working people of the world. So with attitudes like that, Wheeler was not taking on the cases that many of the more hard order people wanted, and Berquin was off. If they did go to court, he was often letting them off. So there was an increasing movement by people, including the governor of the state, Sam Stewart, a conservative Democrat, had been a lawyer in Virginia City before he became moved to Helena to be governor, and he called in early 1918 for a special session of the Montana legislature to address a series of wartime concerns and issues. This included some things about farmers, trying to provide more seeds, better seed banks for farmers, but a lot of it was about dissent, it was about public order. It included, of course, the gun registration measure and more. And so out of that special session, and you should, I assume you all have the handout with the sedition law on it, because I want to spend just a little bit of time on this, because this was the product of the Montana legislature, and one of the reasons it's important is when the federal government decided several months later that it was going to have a sedition law, or actually an amendment to the Espionage Act, they would draw very heavily on it. It was one of Montana's contributions to the First World War. Not just soldiers, not just copper and zinc for those shell casings, but the Sedition Act. So it passed during that two-week special session, and the main part of the Act, Section 1, is what Clemens Work, who is the main historian of this topic of sedition and its response in Montana, calls a single sentence, 376-word Godzilla. And so if you look at Section 1 on your handout, you will see that the first 9 words are, whenever the United States shall be engaged in war. Okay, those are the first 9 words. The last 8 words, 40 lines later, shall be guilty of the crime of sedition. And in between those beginning words and the end words are 38 lines of all the things that if you were tried and convicted would make you guilty of sedition. And I get the impression that when it was time to write this, some lawyer, that Clemens Work believes that probably this bill was written by, he suggests that this bill was written by lawyers in the Anaconda Copper Mining Company up in the Hennessy Building in Butte. It was pushed as a federal bill in 1917 by Henry Myers, Montana's senior senator at that time. It did not make any progress in the Senate. But the language, it has a repetition to it and a redundancy. So here are some of the things that could get you to be convicted guilty of sedition. Any person or persons who shall utter, print, write, or publish any disloyal, profane, violent, scurrilous, contemptuous, slurring, or abusive language about the form of the government of the United States, the Constitution of the United States, the soldiers or sailors of the United States, the flag of the United States, the uniform of the Army or Navy, in any language calculated to bring the form of government constitution bring it down. And so there's this long list of not just things, but the adjectives for the actions, disloyal, profane, and more. And it is one sentence. So this became law, and now, once it became law in February, now it was not putting people who were accused of sedition was not a federal obligation or just a federal. Now it was state. It was basically up to the county attorneys in the counties then. And so Work talks about it was not prosecuted evenly. The southern part of the state with a greater population did get more prosecutions in southeastern Montana, Custer County, where Miles City is, the Silver Bow County, Lewis and Clark County. And so people were prosecuted under this. The Work estimates that there were probably 130, at the state level, 130 or so sedition cases. 79 people were convicted. 41 of those were sentenced to jail time in Deer Lodge. 11 were acquitted. 24 were formally dismissed, and there's about 20 that were unaccounted for. Work characterizes the kind of people that ended up being charged with sedition. He said a lot of it came from what he called offhand outbursts, often in saloons. The people, including employees, bartenders and janitors in saloons, often were accused in their place of work. The people who did it were workers, blue-collar workers, farmers, ranchers, butchers, carpenters, cooks, saloon workers. Over half were born in Europe, and of that half, many in Germany and Austria-Hungary. And most of it involved word of mouth. Someone said something, the Kaiser isn't so bad, or I don't see why we need to be so careful with sugar, you know, as part of food rationing. And so it became word of mouth. He said, all were men. There was one woman went to jail under this. She was a postmaster in southeastern Montana, as well as a rancher, and was heard to say, and so the trials were often very quick and perfunctory. This was actually, it was working exactly as the people who pushed for it. It was very uncritical, on the county level, often very uncritical or very harsh in its sentence. So that's what happened in Montana. But in May of 1918, several months after the special session, the two senators from Montana, Henry Myers and Thomas Walsh, introduced this bill with some changes to the U.S. Congress to make it a part of it as an amendment to the Espionage Act. There were some made, Work says only three words were changed in his book. Actually, there's more than that. The federal government took the last part of the state bill and moved it up to the front. So the phrase disloyal, profane, violent, scurrilous, contemptuous, slurring, or abusive, the words violent, contemptuous, and slurring were pulled out. One of the interesting things is the federal bill, again, it's actually an amendment, does not use the word sedition. The word sedition appears three times in the state act, in the title, in a marginal line, and then at the very end, shall be guilty of the crime of sedition. The word sedition does not appear in the federal amendment of May 1918. So let's look at how this affected certain people, this particular bill, but also the sedition, the whole fear. So the first person I want to look at is Thomas Walsh, the junior senator from Montana at that time. He became senator in 1913, the first senator popularly elected in Montana after the 17th Amendment. He started off the war. He was Irish by background. Both his parents were from Ireland. They were nationalists. They wanted Ireland free from British rule. And so in the early part of the war, he actually opposed the war strongly. Certainly he opposed any kind of alliance between the United States and Britain because of Britain's role in Ireland. He also opposed the U.S. entry into the war because the British blockade, surface blockade of Germany, meant that a lot of Montana exports of copper, wool, zinc, and wheat that might have gone to Germany or Central Europe could not make it now because the British blockade either blocked it or made it so difficult that shippers and merchants decided not to do that. So he's actually fairly outspoken against the war, against the British role in the war, and the fact that the idea that the United States could ever be part of that. As Wilson moves towards war in late 1916, early 1917, Walsh changes. Walsh was actually Wilson's campaign manager in 1916 for Western United States, and Walsh becomes a super patriot. He pushes for sedition. He sponsors making the State Sedition Act into the Federal Sedition Act. And he becomes unquestionably supporting of the official line on the war. Even after the war, when there's labor disturbances in 1919, he pushes for creating a peacetime sedition act to suppress rebels and dissenters and the violent people like the industrial workers of the world, those that continued. And then by 1922, 3 years after the war, he's doing a Senate hearing of the Red Raids, the Mitchell-Palmer Red Scare Raids of the 1920s, and he's back to being a civil libertarian. He's condemning actions that will restrict the expression and actions of people to exercise their First Amendment rights. He goes from anti-war, anti-British, to pro-war, pro-restraints on civil liberties, and then by 3 years after, he's back to where he started. And he will become one of the most respected senators in the early 20th century. He and another Montana senator who basically broke open the corruption of the Harding administration and put one cabinet member in jail and drove the other one out of office. And so he is seen in some ways as a giant of honesty. Just if you've ever seen a picture of him, he looks severe. He just conveys severity, you know, honesty, integrity. And yet for a couple years, he became part of the hysteria. So that's Thomas Walsh. And when addressing his biographer, a man named Leonard Bates, addressed this, his ability to take different sides apparently with full sincerity and full energy, and he was very smart. He was he saw himself as a constitutional lawyer, and this is how Bates tries to explain the big changes. His delight, Walsh's delight in close reasoning, perhaps stimulated him to find a rational way out of his dilemmas, such as that over civil liberties. Whether consciously or not, he often employed his resourceful brain in justifying courses of action at which other times he deplored. Or as Thomas Marshall, Wilson's vice president, said of Walsh, he was and is a politician, this was writing later, and he stood for his convictions, but he would have found a way to have stood for them without being immolated on the altar of his ideals. And so he was someone who adjusted, and you know, we don't know what his internal thinking was. Here's how it affected someone else. There is, if you're interested in this, the Clem Work, who wrote the book Dark Before Dawn, Darkest Before Dawn, has set up a website that has much of this material. It actually has photocopies or photos of actual court documents. It's called the Montana Sedition Project, and if you just Google that, it'll take you there. Fred Rodewald would be the Anglicization. Born in Germany, came to the United States in 1900, settled in Iowa, married, had five children, came to Montana 1912, north of Sumatra, up towards the Muscle Shell country, and settled on a half section. And on the 23rd of April, 1918, he was accused of saying, and again, this is word of mouth. It's even often it's paraphrased in the court documents, and he's accused of saying, that the U.S. would have hard times unless the Kaiser didn't get over here and rule this country. He was accused, tried, convicted, sentenced to 2 to 5 years in Deer Lodge. He was in Deer Lodge when his ninth child was born. He was released. Most of the prisoners were released after a change of government, governorship in early 1920. He left Montana and he moved to Minnesota, where he lived until 1960. And those are the kind of people, poor, often born, you know, perhaps with little understanding of how American government work, how courts worked, perhaps with language issues as well. Someone else who had his reverses, I'm going to move to the national stage now, getting near the end. Someone else who had changes was probably one of the more revered Supreme Court justices, Oliver Wendell Holmes Jr., and who gave us some great phrases. Tom Clancy got a title for a book out of his writing, as you'll see. And Holmes wrote up opinions for two cases that had to do with wartime, the freedom of speech or the lack of freedom of speech or the government's justification for restricting freedom of speech. After the cases came to the Supreme Court after the war had ended. The first one was Schenck versus U.S. It was tried in the Supreme Court in the beginning, first 2 months of 1919, just months after the war had ended. And this is where Holmes came down on the side of the right to government to restrict speech, to restrict free speech. And so two phrases came out of his opinion on Schenck versus the United States. Schenck was a socialist in Philadelphia. And so, and you'll pick them up. So in one section he talks about how you judge whether something should be allowed to be spoken in wartime or not. Whether the words used are used in such circumstances that could create a clear and present danger that Congress has a right to prevent. And the other phrase, which is even better known and often misquoted or misparaphrased, the most stringent protection of free speech would not protect a man in falsely shouting fire in a theater and causing a panic. At the end of 1919, about 10 months later, the Supreme Court faces another case that has to do with rights of free speech. The court rules against free speech in this, but this time, Holmes is one of two dissenting justices, and he writes the dissenting opinion. And he's turned around. He believes that everything should be open, and this is what he writes. The ultimate good desired is better reached by free trade in ideas. So he'd changed, but the court at this point had not. It went against the plaintiffs in this case. So I think of this time period as a time when much of the United States, and it wasn't just the United States, this was happening in virtually every country at war. Some were republics like France, some were constitutional monarchies like Britain and the Dominions, Canada and Australia, some were monarchies and more. It was a time of fear, probably some of it genuine, some of it was fear generated by opportunists who could, you know, whether it's selling newspapers or running for office or trying to build a business. And we've seen it other times in the United States. The so-called McCarthy era, the mid-1950s, the internment of Japanese Americans in 1942, and where people either participated in it or people in positions of some power and authority, I'm thinking again of the internment of the Japanese Americans, chose to stand back and let it proceed. Mike Mansfield was a beginning representative at that time, and the research seems to conclude he just tried to stay out of the way and hope nobody asked him about it. So some of our more revered political figures, Thomas Walsh, Mike Mansfield, have either participated or acquiesced in this. And as we know from current issues, it's not over yet. What I want to finish with is, I don't know if lighthearted is the term, but it's a memoir, and it is a funny story because it ends well, but it's from the memoir by, some of you may have read, Dan Cushman. He's probably best known for a book called Stay Away, Joe. He grew up in Montana. He wrote fiction, he wrote history, and he wrote a book of memoir called Plenty of Room and Air. It was published in 1975. And he was born in 1909, So the war years, the year and a half that the United States was in the war, 1917 and 1918, he lived with his family, 9 to 10 years old, or 8 to 9 years old, in Zurich, on the High Line, the Great Northern Main Line, east of Havre and Chinook. It's between Chinook and Harlem on the High Line, a little town at that time of 100 people. And he describes has a lot in this book about the war. He saw German Americans being forced, pushed to the ground and being forced to kiss the flag, being harassed. He didn't see anyone lynched, but being treated very, very badly. He tells it through a child's eyes, and maybe he just didn't, by the time he wrote this book, he had a pretty low expectation about human behavior, but it's told in a way that's not harsh and condemning. It's told more in almost in a sense of wonder. Look what people do to each other. So there's stories of that, but what I want to finish up with is a story of an extra gang, a big railroad work gang that would live in rail cars and move to large jobs and be parked on sidings where they were changing out the steel rail or replacing ties. And so he starts off with the railroad, the telegraph operator agent in Zurich getting a message over the telegraph line. It was a warning to all points along the line that an extra gang had taken over a work train. The gang, 100 strong, was composed of Austrians and Bulgarians, both allies of Germany. They were flying the Austrian and Bulgarian flags. They were armed to the teeth, and people who attempted to approach the train were being fired on. Next came a report that thousands of industrial workers of the world were on their way from Coeur d'Alene to join them, an attempt to take over the main lines of the Great Northern and Northern Pacific through Montana, cutting the country in half. Everybody in Zurich was looking out for that work train. I was there, too, on the railroad track watching for smoke, but Mama rushed over and got me. Bulgarians were even worse than the Germans. We had a Serbian working on the section gang who lost 5 brothers in the Balkans War, 1912 and 13. And what he said about the Bulgarians, they'd go through a village and slaughter everyone in it. Turns out that people are waiting for the train to go through Zurich. It turns out it had gone through Zurich during the night, and none of us realized how close a call we'd had. Now it was reported at the Matador siding, shipping point for the Matador Cattle Company, east of Harlem. Harlem, the town of Harlem, heard this at the same time as Zurich, so the resident deputy sheriff there got some men together, went down to Matador on a speeder and 2 hand cars. Sure enough, there was the work train, all quiet. Everyone seemed to be sitting around in the shade. Cautious approach, no ambush. A search of the train yielded 2 old sidehammer shotguns. The gang turned out to be Greek, not Bulgarian. There were flags on the cars, 1 flag of Greece and 1 of the United States. Greece was our ally. There'd been shooting, all right. A cook's helper had been hunting and killed a duck. The duck was confiscated. The deputy didn't return empty-handed. He took the cook's helper into custody, transported him to Harlem, where he was fined $10 for hunting out of season. So ended the great Austro-Bulgarian invasion of 1917.